Welcome to the Roundtable Podcast, Season 5, Episode 84. My guest today is the journalist Jorge Barrera. Jorge was born in Caracas, Venezuela, and grew up in Moncton, New Brunswick. He's the winner of the 2012 J-Source News Person of the Year, an honor he received for his reporting on Idle No More and on the exploitation of Akwesasne, a Mohawk community, by criminal networks. Jorge Barrera has written on probably hundreds of topics. I went back through my own newspaper archive and I found articles of his from as early as 2000, so that's 17 years ago. He's worked at CanWest and Sun News, and for the past 7 years, APTN, and now he has a new home at CBC, and I'm really looking forward to see what he does there. If you're an Indigenous person in Canada, or if you have any interest in Indigenous stories, you should be paying attention to Jorge Barrera. He's broken a number of major stories, including the Bruce Carson scandal, which he worked on with Kenneth Jackson, also of APTN, and he led an investigative project into a police anti-drug operation that revealed links between a businessman and some high-profile conservatives. And one of his more recent, highly cited works was a December 2016 investigative article titled Joseph Boyden's Shape-Shifting Indigenous Identity. I think it's fair to say that Jorge Barrera is one of the best investigative journalists working in Canada. In any case, he's one of my favorites. What I like is his detailed, in-depth work, his ability to contextualize an issue and to find just the right way to frame a story. And yet, despite many powerful investigative pieces, I think the general public knows very little about Jorge Barrera, so I'm hoping today maybe we can draw back the curtain a bit. Welcome on the show, Jorge. Was that a fair introduction there? How do you usually introduce yourself?
I'm like a reporter, a journalist, and I think all journalism is investigative at some point. And you know, when I first started like that, I think that article from 2000 is probably from Northern News Services, NNSL.
That's right. I have it here, actually. It's about a mine up in Yellowknife, the Akati Mines.
Yes, that was, yeah.
You've been at this a while. That's my point.
Yes. Yeah. No, you know, that's where I really learned about the craft up in Yellowknife, the people I met, some of the experienced journalists that continue to have, like, what they taught me continues to have an impact on how I see things. And one of the people who had the most impact on me is a guy named Jack Danielchuk, who worked for the Edmonton Journal and then was an editor at News North in Yellowknife, because News North has bureaus in Iqaluit, Rankin Inlet. At least they did when I was there. I think they still do. In Nuvik and Fort Simpson. And I was fortunate enough to actually work in the Iqaluit and Rankin Inlet bureaus. And this was my first ever gig in journalism. I was studying at the University of Victoria. I graduated from Mount A. Then I went to UVic to do this postgrad diploma in professional writing. I never finished it, but I got a job in Yellowknife right from there. And that's where I really learned how to do this. And I think that's the best place to learn journalism, is actually by doing it. And there was just one moment that actually changed the way I looked at stories, changed the way I structured stories. And I was in Yellowknife, and it was around Easter, and in the community of Ray Edzo. Sorry, in the community of Ray Edzo, they had this annual Easter ceremony procession, and basically they would begin at the church, and then the people in the community would then carry the cross around the community, and there would be hymns sung out through a speaker on top of a pickup truck in Dogrib, in the language of the Tlicho people. And it was a striking scene for me. I had never seen anything like that before. It was really moving, because it was very somber, and they did the various stages of Jesus's passion sort of trail, right? Like the different stages. So they would stop at a certain stage and recite a passage, and it was all done in their own language. And so I was really moved by this, and I came back I drove back to Yellowknife to do the story, and I was just getting into every single detail, the rosary beads, you know, slipping through the wrinkled hands of an elder sitting in the church with the fan spinning. Anyways, it was just getting too long, and Jack Danielchuk came over. He looked at my copy. He told me to get out of my chair, and he sat down, and he just totally ripped it apart and rewrote it. And he wrote about 4 or 5 paragraphs, and he said, "There, now finish it." So I had to finish it following the sort of the rhythm of his writing, the structure of it. And that's how I learned to write a new story, just by being able to just see what he did and then trying to match it for the rest of the way. But he was also really, he had an incredible news sense. And I remember when it came out, someone found out that someone had died of tuberculosis in Inuvik. And he jumped all over that. And we turned that into an issue, because he was like, you know, this disease should not be around. And it's still an issue.
Yeah.
But I remember how hard he pushed me to go after the story, because he felt it was incredibly important, because it was a symptom of the inequality that exists in this country between the original inhabitants and everybody else. And he really went after it with a passion. And he also covered the Indigenous Affairs beat for the Edmonton Journal until they cut the beat. So I learned a lot from him, and I had an amazing chance to cover Nunavut, Inuktitut, and Rankin Inlet. And, you know, and after that, I ended up, you know, working in Meadow Lake in Saskatchewan and in Kenora, Ontario. And through like the early part of my career, there was really nobody ever really talked about the idea of like a quote Indigenous Affairs beat, because in all these places and communities and territories I worked in, like in Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories, it's like Treaty 8, Treaty 11. That was like part of the discourse. It wasn't something unknown. It was part of how people politically discussed the territory. And I had a crush. And at the time, Stephen Cockrey was premier of the NWT. He's known for his Bob Dylan guitar singing. He was amazing. He's an amazing, you know, character, politician, and he was really impressive. I never really had this notion of sort of Indigenous, quote, Indigenous Affairs being something separate. It was the story in all those places. It was one of the main political drivers in Meadow Lake, in Kenora, and obviously in Northwest Territories and Nunavut. So from early on, it was always the story. And as a journalist, you always want to write stories that matter, stories that where the stakes are the highest. And for me, those were the stories that were the most important stories in the communities that I worked in. So I've always always covered that, because I was just sort of part of the landscape. And even when I worked at, you know, the Irving newspapers, the Times Transcripts, and I covered provincial politics for them, you know, I tried to keep a handle on what was going provincially. And then when I moved over to CanWest and Sun Media, I still, you know, chased those stories. When I was working at Sun Media, I covered that beat when I worked for the National Bureau.
Well, you've been around long enough, and so have I, that I do remember when there was such a thing as a native beat, as they used to call it. And you don't really see that anymore, but, you know, I got to know everybody who was doing that. And most of them didn't really have any background in it. You know, they were mostly non-Indigenous people, and they were kind of learning as they went. It sounds like you had a lot of that experience. How did you first end up there? Because that's not your background. For people who don't know, I mean, you have roots in Venezuela. You can maybe talk a bit about that, but you're not Indigenous.
No.
How did you end up kind of finding yourself in that world?
because of an interesting story about that. So yeah, I was born in Caracas. My mom is Venezuelan and met my father in Venezuela. But a lot of my father's family is from Colombia, and there's links to in Medellin. And I worked in Venezuela for an English language daily called the Daily Journal in 2004. In the summer of 2004, there was a recall referendum on Hugo Chavez. And so the referendum, to understand the story, the opposition managed to get enough signatures to trigger a referendum. And so there was a referendum on whether on the presidency, and the vote was going to be whether you think there should be, should there be a referendum on Chavez, yes or no? And so the opposition side was the yes side, and the Chavista side was no. So, you know, it was all red shirts with the word no on it and stuff like that. So the vote was on Sunday. I think it was August 15th, the vote. Anyways, it was going to be on a Sunday. And so on the Thursday, there was an international press conference at the palace in Miraflores. So I went to the conference, and they did a lottery. I think only like 7 reporters got picked, a split between domestic and foreign, but it was like 300 press. It was packed. It was a lot of press there. I didn't get picked in the lottery, but I really wanted to ask Chavez a question because I had missed my chance. Like the week before, he spoke at the Hilton, and I was with a bunch of reporters waiting for him to finish his speech, and he like walked right by me, and I didn't get a question, and this BBC guy next to me got an interview with him, like just scrimming him. So I was like, I need to ask him a question. And as he was finishing up, you know, he took like 15, 20 minutes to answer every question. So I thought, you know, if I get a question, and then I had done a couple of freelance pieces for Canadian press. And so I was in contact with him. So I really wanted to get a Canadian angle. So during his discourse, Chavez talked about the kingdom of the devil in North America. And this was the first time I had been back in Venezuela since I was born. I left when I was 6. I left with my grandparents, and they went settled in Moncton of all places. I was in like Miami Beach a while. Like
that's a bit of a change.
I know. I was in Miami Beach, like you know, when I in my early 20s, and there was all these Latinos everywhere. I was like, and there's a lot of Venezuelans in Miami, and I was like, why did we move here? Anyway. So it was my first time back. So sort of getting to know my country. I met my father for the first time when I was down there. So I really wanted to get a question in on Chavez. So I wait as he was finishing up his last question. I got up out of my chair. I went to the wall near the door where he came in, and I started inching towards the doorway. And I thought, well, as he leaves, I'm going to throw him a question. And so he wrapped up his last question, and he stopped when he finished answering. He looked around. Are there any more questions? And I was like right in front of him, basically. And I put my hand up and I was like, I have a question. And he looked at me. You have a question? I was like, yeah, I have a question from Canada. And he goes, Canada? Eres Hindio? He's like, are you Indian? Sort of straight translation. He thought I was First Nation from Canada. And I was like, no, I'm from here. And I could see the disappointment sort of scurry across his face.
Oh, you're from here. Oh, well.
Yeah. An expat. Well, he's like an expat, right? And so I asked him, you know, you mentioned the kingdom of the devil in North America. Because I was in my head, I had the headline. I was like, so do you think that Canada is part of the kingdom of the devil? And he said, no. Like the no, we're going to vote on Sunday. No. And he got up and he walked out. And I was like, oh, my goodness. Like you took 20 minutes to answer every question. Like, I mean, if you would have said yes, I mean, I thought that was a great story.
That would have been a great story. Yeah.
Canada, part of the kingdom of the devil.
The Round Table, WayneKSpear.com.
So I'm still wondering how you ended up kind of going into journalism.
Well, I mean, why I got into journalism, I mean, it was Sports Illustrated. I mean, I played high school football and stuff, and my grandmother got me these like subscription to Sports Illustrated. And it was back when magazine writing, like print was still like, this is the mid 90s. So print still really mattered. So yeah. The Sports Illustrated used to do these amazing profiles on athletes, and two stuck out in particular. There's one on Roy Jones Jr., who used to be pound for pound, the best boxer in the world. And it was about Roy Jones growing up with his father who raised fighting roosters. And so they made the connection between his father raising these fighting roosters. By the way, I saw a rooster fight in Caracas, and Roy Jones and his fighting. And there was another one about Jerry Rice, about how Jerry Rice's father was a bricklayer and he used to throw him bricks. And Jerry Rice developed his hands catching his father throwing, like catching bricks. Wow. So I just found that amazing how they would take, you know, they would take the background of these athletes and then and have it informed like their success. And I remember the writing was just incredible. And I was really captivated by that. So I quit. So anyways, I went to Mount A. So I looked forward to getting my Sports Illustrated and reading those profile pieces. I always liked writing. Like I always read, like I read Tolkien when I was a little kid and all that stuff. So books were always pushed on me. So I went to Mount A. I played 1 year of football, my first year. I'm not very big. So I quit after my first, I played wide receiver. It was, you know, for high school, it was, but university, you have to like work out all the time and it's like another job. And it wasn't my thing. I realized, you know, this isn't really me. Like, I don't think I have the physical abilities to be really good up here. So I quit and I decided I wanted to be a journalist. I just wanted to try it. And the Argosy, the student newspaper, there was no more openings to work in the student newspaper by the time I realized I wanted to try it my second year. So I joined, they were starting this online thing. So I joined their online team to cover sports. And I think my first story was like about intramurals or something. But I was still friends with people from the team. So one day, one of the guys from the team came in and he was freaking out. And he's like, man, they just fired the coach. I was like, why? It was because one of the fullback had tested positive for steroids. And he's like, they fired the coach because of the steroid stuff, da da da. And I was like, holy, that's a story. So I called up the sports editor and I called him and I said, hey man, like they just fired the coach because there's someone, an athlete got caught with steroids. He's like, that sounds like a great story. I can't wait to read it. And he hung up on me. So I cut classes for 2 days chasing the story, and I did this big piece on it, and yeah, and then the sports editor, I think his nickname was Oyster. Anyways, he quit, and then they named me the sports editor, and I ended up working with Marty Patrickin, who was with McLean's, is now a well-known commentator and writer. At Montreal, I worked with him for a couple of years on the Argosy, and also with Greg Quinn, who works for Bloomberg here in Ottawa. And there was another person, Megan Venner. She worked for CBC in Edmonton. So, anyway, that is how it started, and I got hooked on it. And I did 2 years as sports editor. Then I was the features editor, and then I applied to go to after my. I did religious studies. I applied to go to King's College, do my bachelor's in journalism. And then I also got accepted at University of Victoria. And if you grew up on the East Coast, everybody's older brother always comes back from BC with like a bushy beard, wearing plaid and a faraway look in their eyes. So you're like, I want to go there.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay.
But you didn't come back with the bushy beard. No. What went wrong?
I went north. So I went to Victoria to do that, but I never finished it was a Harvey Southern diploma, professional writing. I got to work with one of my teachers was James McKinnon, who's he's published like three books. His latest one is on like how on the environment and where to go next. He's an incredible writer. He did a piece about his uncle, who was a priest in the DR in the Dominican Republic, who was I think murdered. Anyways, I learned a lot from him. He was associated with Adbusters. So he taught a class on their sort of journalistic toolbox. I wrote some stuff for the Martlet and stuff, and then I through the editor of the Martlet, she had a friend in Yellowknife, and I applied up there, and they hired me. Bruce Falpe hired me, and that's how it began.
So I'm going to read a short quotation. This is when you did an interview in 2013 with the Canadian Media Guild, and it was just after your award was announced. And this is something that you said that I thought really, this was just a brilliant perspective. And I think it says a lot about you. So the quotation is, "It's up to us as individual reporters to keep it important to stop focusing so much on lack of resources and dig inside for our own resources if we believe in the necessity of investigative journalism for our communities and for our country." And I just thought, what a great way to look at it, because we're all obsessed with resources. You mentioned the previous importance of print media, and certainly those days aren't coming back anytime soon, if ever. And this idea of digging inside for our own resources, which is actually a good description of what you do, because you're one of these people out there who just use everything at your disposal, social media, you know, more traditional journalistic approaches. And when I read this, I just thought, boy, if we could all look at it like this. I mean, because we're working in difficult times, aren't we, for journalism? And I know lots of journalists who've lost their job and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do next. So I think this is a great way to look. I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
Well, I mean, the reason I said that is because I worked in, you know, one reporter weekly newspaper in Meadow Lake, Saskatchewan, right? I was lucky I didn't have to lay out and I didn't have to cover sports, but I wrote the editorial and I wrote all the stories and I took photos. And then I worked in Kenora. I worked for the weekly, it was called the Kenora Enterprise, and then I switched to the daily. And that's when I talk about digging in to find your own resource. I mean, when I was there, there was like two of us. There was two reporters. We obviously we had an editor, and we had an entertainment guy, and I think sometimes we actually did sports, but we had to fill a daily newspaper every single day. It was an afternoon daily, so you could actually, you know, so you actually could work into the morning early and have something fine. But we were just writing, you know, all like in terms of no resources, but we still like dug, we just went after stories all the time. And I realized that, you know, you actually, in journalism isn't rocket science. There's no special formula or magic, but it gives you back what you put in. If you throw a lot at something, chances are something's going to come out. And so I realized that at that point where, when I was working for the Minor News, that like, if you really go after it and you're able to keep multiple stories going at the same time, even if you have not a lot of support, you can still do good stuff. And I think I did pretty good stuff at the Minor News. I think we broke some stories. I got kicked off. I mean, the police chief got me kicked off the police beat, and then,
oh man,
he got, yeah, I was investigated.
That's how you know you're doing a good job.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there was some incidents. I was a lot more hot-headed back then too. Uh-huh. I was pretty aggressive. But so the police chief didn't want to deal with me. Partly there was an off-duty officer that drowned. And so I actually went to the cop shop to try to talk to someone having a smoke about him. There is an issue with the Max Kakagamic case, which is still, he was murdered. And it's still, his murder still has never, there's that's a whole other thing. There's been some pieces done on it, but it's still outstanding. There's a drug bust. And anyways, I got some information on a drug bust and the OPP was like wondering how I got it. Anyways, all these. So anyways, there was all these issues. And so they got taken off the police beat, put on City Hall. And I found out that the police was spraying their lawn with herbicides or pesticides. It was some chemical. Anyways, and the city council had like passed a motion against using this. I think it was a herbicide. I could be wrong. It was either a herbicide or pesticide, whatever. They passed a motion against whatever they were spraying. And so I did a story about how they were doing this against this motion. And the police chief called me back, and I'll never forget the message he sent to me. He left me, and they disbanded the Kenora police force, by the way. The OPP, I think, patrols Kenora now. And his message was like, "You mongering little shit disturbing asshole. Like, I came for you once and I'm coming for you again," or something like that. It was like, anyway.
Yeah. So, did you get a lot of that?
Not a lot. Where he was really upset.
It comes with the territory, doesn't it?
Yeah, so
the big thing now is Thunder Bay. I know some people are going up there, and mm-hmm. that's something I've been watching. And boy, I mean, I think if and when we get to the bottom of that, it's going to be some nasty stuff there too.
Yep.
You don't need to comment on that. That's just my observation. When you were describing Kenora, I thought of some of the things I'm reading.
Kenora
about Thunder Bay.
Kenora, I've been up to Thunder Bay a couple times, and yes, Kenora, you can draw parallels. When I was there in Kenora in like early 2000s, yes. The thing with Thunder Bay, it's a bigger place, and it just seems to be more of a concentration of things. So yeah, no, I think Thunder Bay is a national issue, and I'm glad that people are going up there. I'm glad that Robert Yago, he's going to put out a piece soon. I know Ryan McMahon wants to do a podcast, and then, you know, big shout out to, you know, some of the work that AP10 has done up there, and also Jody Porter from CBC, who, you know, like, we wouldn't know a lot of the things if it wasn't for some of her reporting. So those people need to be definitely acknowledged.
Yeah. I mean, you did 7 years at AP10, mm-hmm. had a really good run there, and just a great news agency. And I'm so thrilled to see that they're going to be opening up stations now, one in my city here, Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to that. I lived in Ottawa for years, so I knew people there, you know, Jennifer David and a bunch of people who were working, Karen Pugliese.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, that might have been before your time. Yeah, I think it was. Jim Compton, another guy I know from there. Anyways, it's good to see what they're doing. And now you're at the CBC, and that's exciting too, because mm-hmm. you're not going to have problems with resources, and you've got a nice platform there. Mm-hmm. So I think you're really in a good place now to keep doing what you're doing, which is, I think you have a lot of intellectual curiosity and tenacity, and you don't stop until you get to the truth. And it sounds corny, but that's what it takes to be a journalist. You want to know the truth.
Yeah. Journalism, I like to see it a bit like, you know, look at like the beat poets, right? And the Stonies and stuff, and how they saw themselves, and how like poetry was everything. And even if they weren't, like, it was, even if the poor and like living in flats and being angel headed hipsters and all that stuff, like, you know, it was a lifestyle, and the poetry was the thing. Writing was the thing. It was how they sort of, you know, engaged with their existence in the world. And I think, you know, journalism for me is a lifestyle. It is how I relate to, you know, the world, and it's my contribution to society, to my community. And it's not, and a lot of, you know, my friends who are journalists, you know, are the same way. People like, you know, Gary Dimmick and Kenneth Jackson, who have hung out with, you know, gone to bonfires with them. And, you know, it's a lifestyle, and
that gives me some insight into you, because there were always the two schools, especially people writing on politics. There was the sort of poli-sci people, right,
mm-hmm.
who were policy or governance, or, you know, kind of coming at it from that perspective. And then there were the people, folks like me, who were English literature majors and who fell in love with language and mm-hmm. with poetry. So anytime we were writing something, our first concern was for the rhythm of the language mm-hmm. and for the metaphor and for the broader strokes of the human drama that we all learn from things like Shakespeare, which sounds pretentious and ridiculous, but I did learn a lot about politics reading Shakespeare, you know, kings and queens and people, you know, fighting and trying to outmaneuver one another and always bringing that literary background to everything I was doing. It sounds to me like you know what that's about. You kind of have a similar take.
Yeah.
Maybe I've overstated it, but you're a writer first in a weird sort of way, and then journalism is an extension of language and of understanding human beings.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It's, you know, I fell in love with the language in those Sports Illustrated profiles, and I wanted to try to replicate that. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. I fell in love with Mad Magazine. That's kind of how I see human beings, is we're all kind of strange and absurd a lot of the times. It's kind of a satirical take on things. And when I was young, that was the kind of stuff I was reading, as well as, you know, various novels and things. So I think this is a good kind of place to wrap up here. Mm-hmm. I thank you profusely for giving me your time, because I know you're probably working on 10 things right now, right? Or 11. So I'm glad that we could sit down and talk, because you're probably the person I've known the longest that I've never actually had a conversation with. I mean, we've talked on the phone going back 15 years. Mm-hmm. I know I had a conversation with you. And, mm-hmm. and so I don't know why. And we've been at meetings or covered things together, you know, various events. So this is good. I'm glad you were able to do this.
Yes. Well, thank you for the invitation.
Yeah. And maybe we'll catch up sometime when you've been there for a little while and see how things are going.
All right.
But check him out, Jorge Barrera. I'm sure you've heard of him, but now at CBC Indigenous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot, Jorge.
Yes. Thank you so much.